Hey folks, Paul Brooks here with you once again for another B-Movie Mania interview. Today I'm talking with Matt Blasi. He's co-host of the GARF Network podcast. GARF is the George A. Romero Foundation. He is the author of 8 Days in the Woods, which is all about the making of the original Blair Witch Project. And he was a zombie in not one, but two of George Romero's movies, Land of the Dead and Survival of the Dead. If you know me at all, it should be pretty obvious that I was very excited to sit down and talk with Matt about all of this stuff. I'm a huge George Romero fan. I am a very big Blair Witch Project fan, and we had quite the conversation, so I hope you enjoy it. Here is my interview with Matt Blasi.
It's B-Movie Mania!
Matt, welcome to B-Movie Mania, and thank you so much for sitting down to chat with me for a couple minutes.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to sit down and have a talk.
Absolutely. I'm excited because I'm a very big George Romero fan, and I'm also a very big Blair Witch fan. So I feel like you and me are probably going to get along pretty well.
Sounds like it. Anyone that likes both of those, I tend to get along with pretty well.
Yeah. I don't know. Where do you want to start? There's so much to talk about. I know that you have a Blair Witch experience coming up pretty soon. Is that correct? You want to talk about that?
Yeah, the Blair Witch Experience this year will be October 22nd and 23rd. It is the film location tour for the Blair Witch Project. I take fans around from Burkittsville to the woods, and we revisit all the filming locations used in the film. That it'll be that same weekend, 25 years to the day that they started filming that the Blair Witch Experience will be happening. So it's kind of an interesting weekend. We've had very truncated versions of the experience during COVID, but I've been doing it since 2013, and people want to go see where it was. And I mean, it's in the woods, so it's not always the most easily accessible, especially now in the summertime. It's a lot overgrown. You can't really see much, but October is the perfect time. It's spooky season, and it's great to get into the woods and kind of realize the type of movie magic that Ed and Dan and the Haxan guys put Heather, Mike, and Josh through while making them look lost in the woods, where in actuality, 5 minutes in any direction will get them to someone's backyard or a major road. And it's fun to go back and retrace their steps and realize the ingenuity that went into making that film.
Mm-hmm. That is unbelievable that it's been 25 years since they started shooting that.
Yeah, they shot in 1997 from October 22nd to, it was supposed to end before Halloween, but they lost an entire day to rain, reshot the day, used none of the reshoot day, and the final night, the first night that they entered the house from the film, they only got about half the night. The battery and the light on the 16mm camera kept dying. So they actually came back the next night and finished up. So it was supposed to be 6 days and ended up being 8 days. But yeah, it was a very interesting shoot. It was a lot more in-depth than what I ever thought of as a fan back in 1999.
I was just going to ask, are you someone who caught the initial wave when the first film came out and it was, you know, the massive cultural phenomenon, or did you kind of come into it a little bit later?
I came into it in the spring of 99. I think the first time I may have seen a trailer might have been April or May. And I remember the trailer was attached to Star Wars Episode I. And that summer was the summer I graduated high school and I was waiting to go off to college. So it was that fun summer. You're moving away to college. It's all exciting, but you're kind of waiting around. You're working a little bit. And the internet was great because we had dial-up and it was on AOL. You know, I don't know how many folks out there remember the old AOL, but that was the epitome of the internet back in 1999. Chat rooms, instant messenger, all that stuff. And I just remember spending my summer typing in the Blair Witch Project wherever I could. It wasn't even Google at that point. You know, we were Yahoo, AltaVista, Lycos, all that old stuff.
Right.
And there were actually a couple of websites devoted to this film. The film wasn't even out yet. And I never believed it was true, but I was just so enthralled by the concept that this is something different. From as a lifelong horror fan, I wasn't sure what to expect. And I didn't know much. And I still don't like to know too much about a movie when I go and see it. Especially if it's a horror film or something that's a little different, because I kind of want to go in with a blank slate.
Agreed.
Blank canvas. And to me, that means that's probably why I enjoy more most films more than other people do. But I would look at the websites and I would read about it, and they would make, you know, wallpapers from the trailer and sounds, you know, that, you know, I don't know how old you are, but, you know, desktop themes were the big thing on the Windows computers. You had the wallpaper, sure. The icons, the special, you know, mouse pointers and all and everything. And there was a couple Blair Witch ones. And I was like downloading everything I could, all the wallpapers, all the little clips. And I couldn't wait to get in the theater. And the closer we got, the more anxious I was getting. And I think, I honestly don't know another film since then that I had been that excited to go see. And I was glued to my seat the entire time because, again, I had no clue what to expect. This was the first time I can really remember anticipating a movie. I was 18. So there were films I'm like, yeah, I'm excited to go see that. But like this one, it was like I couldn't miss it. And I remember buying tickets earlier in the day. And by the time I came back to the theater tonight, everything was sold out. There was just papers across the box office. Blair Witch Project, 7 o'clock, 7:10, 7:15, sold out. It's just sold out. And I mean, I think there were more people in that theater than there were for something like Avengers Endgame or Infinity War. I don't think I've ever been in a theater more packed than I was that summer, even for a Star Wars movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely a cultural phenomenon. You said that you have been a horror fan for most of your life, and you're part of the GARF network, the George A. Romero Foundation. You have the awesome backdrop behind you right now. Can you talk a little bit about what it is that you do specifically for the GARF network? You know, what got you initially interested in George's movies and all that good stuff?
Boy, that's a lot to unpack there, and it's going to be a long story, so hang on.
That's fine.
Well, in the beginning, I grew up a George fan. I was a fan of George Romero before I knew who George was. I remember seeing Dawn of the Dead, age 3, 4. My dad taped it. I don't know why. And I started watching it because it preceded Superman 3 and Superman 4. Now, Superman 3 had come out prior to Dawn, and I think Superman 4 got added. But I would watch that videotape like on a Saturday morning in the living room before my parents would get up, and it would go right into Superman 3. And I was just, I was just floored by Dawn of the Dead. It was just so cool. And the mall by me had Penny's in the same location that the Monroeville Mall did. It was right in the center, and it had kind of the similar, it was the same layout, the plants and the water fountains and stuff. So I go to my local mall and I think, this is like that zombie movie. And I ended up seeing a lot of George films before I knew his name, which probably I didn't know until a little bit later when I started reading Fangoria magazine and, you know, kind of understanding who George was. Go to the video store and pick up the videotape. Oh, this is the guy that did Dawn of the Dead. He does Day of the Dead. Okay, I'm going to rent it. So I stayed. I mean, obviously a big fan. I had a website. When I started that in 99 as well, it was the Dawn of the Dead page. I was a big fan. I lived 3 hours from the Monroeville Mall, so I started making pilgrimages to the mall. You know, I was a kid in a candy store there, and I still do to this day. And that just kind of snowballed and continued, and that was message board days. So we started to build friendships with people on message boards with their screen names, and then these things, movie conventions, like you can go meet the people from the movie. Oh my God, this is great. So I started doing that. And I started doing that for years, and I ended up seeing George a lot, and I ended up getting to know folks in George's circle, just becoming friends with them by talking to them, keeping in contact with them. And I ended up being in two of George's films. I was in Land of the Dead and Survival of the Dead. And that's a whole nother story that I could spend.
Oh, we're going to talk about that specifically. Don't worry.
And, you know, George passed away in July of 2017. And a friend of mine that I'd known at that point for almost 20 years, he said, hey, we should do a George podcast and just talk about all the stuff about George that people don't talk about. You know, we'll talk about Dawn of the Dead, but let's talk to someone behind the camera that we don't hear about. So we started focusing on the second, third, fourth level people that were there, but that people don't really look to talk to. And I got a phone call one day from Suze Romero, because we had had her on the show a few times. And she said, hey, the foundation's looking to expand. Would you guys like to do a show in conjunction with us? And it was for the anniversary of George's passing. So we did a Day of the Dead and Night of the Living Dead watch along. And we had cast and crew from day and night come on while we did this like marathon film watch. A couple weeks later, Suze called and said, hey, we're talking to the folks at Shudder, and there's this new movie called Host coming out. Did you want to sit and talk with the folks that did Host? And I was like, yeah, that movie looks pretty cool. I'm ready to, you know, yeah, let's do it. So I watched Host, which ended up becoming my favorite film of 2020. The show we did with the cast and crew of Host was still probably one of my top two or three favorite shows that we've ever done. Because those guys are just awesome. Oh, that was such a fun show. Jed and Rob and the girls were just fantastic. And after that, Suze called back and said, would you want to come do this full time for the foundation? And I mean, my answer was an immediate yes. Eric was on board. Eric Kent's my co-host. And we decided that in October that year, we'll keep doing our show, but we're going to rebrand as the Garf Network. And that was during COVID. So we had adopted, instead of an audio only, we decided to use a video format so people could watch along and we could throw them on YouTube and, you know, just have a little bit more fun.
Mm-hmm.
So we started doing that, and we started branching out and talking to folks in the independent horror scene. One of our first shows was with Rusty Cundiff from Tales from the Hood, who has become a great friend. We did a huge My Bloody Valentine reunion. That show went way different than we were anticipating, because I emailed George Mahalka, the director, and on the subsequent email back, he had CC'd the entire cast. So we went from like one person to nine, and we ended up having to add a second show because he kept adding people to the email. So we did a whole like cast one, and then we did a whole crew one, which was fantastic.
It's a good problem to have.
It was one of the easiest shows I've ever done, because these guys are all friends and they hadn't really seen each other during COVID. So Eric and I hit broadcast, and I think we sat back for 3.5 hours while these guys just had a blast.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, they'd be like, oh, Matt and Eric, do you guys have anything? And at that point, we're like, you know, just keep going. We're good. Like, we're not going to tread, you know, we weren't going to break new ground, but that's kind of the niche that I think Eric and I like to do, is when we talk to someone about whether it's their career or a specific film, I want to hear the stories that they don't get a chance to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing I say. I was like, look, if there is an aspect of this story, this film, or this career that you've never gotten a chance to talk about, let's talk about it. And don't be afraid to go off on a story tangent. Like, this is your time. Like, we're just here to facilitate the conversation, and it's a conversation. We don't do interviews, and we like to have a good time and laugh. So we've been doing that with the foundation for, I guess, a little over 2 years now. And that's been, you know, absolutely wonderful. I couldn't love Suze and that crew more than I possibly do.
Yeah, that's so cool, you know, that Suze asked you if you wanted to expand it. That's really awesome.
Yeah, it was, I was honored. And it's, to me, it's a way to give back to George for everything that he gave me and my friends and the the pop culture. I mean, we have The Walking Dead because of George.
Right.
So any reason to help Suze and George and those folks involved, I'm absolutely going to do. I have no problem doing whatever it is they need. And, you know, we spent an entire month last year celebrating Knight Riders that had turned 40. And we had Ed Harris on our show. And getting Ed Harris for 2 hours to talk about Knight Riders, that was amazing.
I bet.
And Ed was one of the absolute coolest dudes. And I'm sitting in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh my God, I'm talking to Ed Harris about this movie from 40 years ago. And people probably want to talk about Westworld and Apollo 13, and Appaloosa and all this stuff. And I'm like, we're talking about George. And he has such a reverence for George. And that warmed my heart because George, you know, two of his first three roles or so were with George between Knight Riders and Creepshow. And I'm like, I'm talking to Ed Harris. Like, how cool is this? Like, and I could sit there and listen to him talk all night because he's an eloquent storyteller. So stuff like that, it's a great byproduct to build these relationships with folks that you grew up watching and probably never thought you'd get a chance to talk to. And when you sit and talk to them, they're just so excited to tell certain stories. And I can't speak enough about how awesome that foundation is.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about getting to know George, maybe when you first met George, and then segueing into that, kind of the whole reason that you and me started chatting on Twitter was the fact that you were in Land of the Dead and Survival of the Dead, and I'm just dying to know what those experiences were like for you.
Well, I met George for the first time in October of 2000. My roommate's a friend of mine in college, her boyfriend went to Westchester University. And it's always like, I'm a huge geek nerd. I mean, I wave that flag proudly. So my college dorm room was covered in posters from George Romero, Blair Witch Project, you know, anything horror related I had a poster of. So George was coming to Westchester University. And I was like, I can meet George Romero. So my now wife, then girlfriend, we drove down to Westchester. We were only about 2 hours away. And he was just doing like a meet and greet Q&A kind of thing. And I mean, I didn't know what to expect. Walk into this little room in a library. I mean, you probably could have held 40 people in there. And there was probably 25 or 30 of us. And I remember the first time I ever laid eyes on George, he was sitting at a table in another room. And I looked through the door. I was like, that's George. Oh my God, he's coming in. And he did like a little meet and greet beforehand. He was like, oh, does anyone want a picture? And I was like, yeah. So I was like, I have this picture. And I had a big cheesy grin on my face and sat down. And he was like, all right, kind of gave, you know, talked some stories. He's like, well, who's got some questions? And I remember this question. I was like, at that point, the rumor was that he had shot an alternative ending for Dawn of the Dead, where Galen and Ken Furry's characters commit suicide. And there was rumors that there was footage. So I got a question. And I just remember being this like big fanboy. I could barely contain it. And he said, oh yeah, well, we shot some of it, but ultimately decided not to. But so it really didn't work out. And I was like, confirmation, there's footage. And I was like, oh, I couldn't believe it. And afterward, he was done talking and he's like, well, I was going to show you guys Night of the Living Dead, but I have a feeling y'all have seen it. Would you like to see my new one, Bruiser? And I was like, yeah. Oh, my God. So he pops in a VHS, an unmarked VHS type of Bruiser. It was done edited. It was all color corrected. And that moment is why I love Bruiser. It's my second favorite Romero film. And it's widely known that I hate saying it. I'm the biggest Bruiser fan. I love Bruiser. I love Bruiser because of that moment. And I love it because I saw what George was doing. And I felt that those were the movies George wanted to make. So we watched Bruiser and I was like, I need to see this film like now. Like I need this film in my face. And he was like, all right, well, I'm going to go outside. If anyone has anything they want me to sign, come on up. He goes out to a park bench, lights a cigarette, and we get in line and just he starts signing stuff. I think he signed four things for me that night. No charge, no handler, no one telling him he's got to go.
Wow.
George just sat there and smoked a couple cigarettes and signed for fans for, I think, for at least an hour. Because I was like one of the first few, and then I just stood there and watched him. So it was probably about 2 years later that I saw him again, and I started seeing him at conventions. And I started to become friends with the folks that have worked with him, especially the Dawn folks. And I started seeing Georgia conventions and got to know his manager. So I would go and I would hang and talk to his manager. And then I would sit with George at his table and work with him for a little bit. And that segued into finally meeting Greg Nicotero in 2003 at the Pittsburgh Comic Con. And you know, Greg's wonderful. If you've never met Greg, I highly recommend you travel to meet him. He's the epitome of a fan first who never forgot he was a fan. And, you know, with a resume like his, he knows he's a fan and he acts like it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 2003. Saw him again in 2004. Him and George were at Horror Find and they were starting production on Dead Reckoning. But it was going to be shot in Canada, so they didn't know what they were going to do. But I had kept in touch with Greg. He goes, look, I'll see what I can do, me and another guy, if we can get you up or whatnot. He's like, but Canada's extra laws are pretty weird, strict compared to the U.S. So we got an email from Greg about a week or so prior. He said, hey, you guys can come on up for the night. He goes, I can't promise you anything, but you can come. So we hopped in the car and we drove to Toronto, my first time out of the United States. Didn't need a passport, just needed your birth certificate and driver's license. I was like, oh man, I'm in a foreign country. This is so weird. And we get the set and Greg pops out of a trailer and he's like, hey guys, how's it going? Come here. He calls us over. I said, all right. And he calls someone else over. He goes, okay, him, I want in that trailer and him in that trailer. Let's go. And I was like, what are we doing? He said, oh, we're going to get you in makeup tonight. We have a big extras night. And I was like, I'm going to be a zombie in a George Romero movie. Like when you talk about a bucket list item, everyone's got that one thing they want to do or see or experience in life.
Yeah.
I was unknowingly going to be living mine that night. And I remember walking into the trailer. Now I didn't know anybody. I didn't know much about production. But I walk in and there's three zombies being made up. It was the gentleman who was the tambourine zombie, Boyd Banks, who was the butcher, and then in the chair next to me was this ginormous human being, Big Daddy, Eugene Clark. And he's laid back and he's got his eyes closed and he's getting made up. And I sit down in the chair and Greg's like, Tracy, this is my friend Matt. Matt, this is Tracy. And Tracy made me up. She put appliances on my face and makeup and got to talking to her. And I was like, I don't care if I'm 100 yards in the background. Like I did not care.
Yeah.
About an hour, hour and a half. I'm all done. Greg comes and goes, oh, come here. And he puts, put some contacts in my eyes. He said, here, commemorate this. Takes my picture. He's like, wow. This doesn't go on the internet. He's like, don't. And they were strict about it. I said, right hand to God. So I have one picture on my digital camera at the time as a zombie. And they cart us off the set. Me and the other guy, Lee, we're in this van and we're being shuffled downtown Toronto. Like you can see the CN Tower. It's a cold October night. It's foggy. It's a little bit of rain, but they shuffle us to Brookfield Place. It used to be called BCE Place, where they were shooting. We were supposed to break in. So when you in Land of the Dead, we're breaking into Fiddler's Green. Obviously, we had no context. And we get there, and Greg puts us second in line. There's main row of all your zombies, and then us. And I'm like, whoa. I'm looking through the window, and there's three cameras. One center and then off 45 degree angle. And they said, okay, here's what you're going to do. You guys are going to start up here. We're going to yell action. You're going to shuffle down the steps and you're going to come to the window and, you know, do your thing. The first take, action. and we shuffle and I take like three steps and they're like, cut. I was like, I'm done. I walked as a George Romero zombie. I could have left there and just been absolutely floored.
Yeah.
So we did that. We did that a couple of times and we finally got to the window. We finally did our walk up to the window. And I remember the first time I really saw George direct, because we were kind of standing there, and in the movie, you hear these guards, you know, holy shit. And then you see them run very quick across the frame as we're walking up. Well, I guess these guys just, they couldn't get it. There was something that they weren't doing or were doing that kind of upset George. Like George kind of shot out of his director's chair and he's pointing over here, and I'd never seen George animated, but I'm watching him work. So they scrapped, I guess they were going to do a reverse shot and they kind of scrapped it. So we're doing a couple takes and they keep wetting us down a little bit because they were like, well, you need to be wet. Obviously, I didn't know it was after they come out of the river and they're walking through the city. So we're beating on the window and they're like, all right, we're going to blow the window and then you guys are going to come through. I was like, ooh, a stunt. And they give me a pickaxe and I'm second in line and we're supposed to beat against it a couple of times, and Big Daddy has this jackhammer and he's beating against the wall. So they're like, okay, on the count of three, it's going to pop. And they gave us all little earbuds. And it was like, one, two. And it was like this loud, poof, and it's spider webs. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. So we do the scene where they're breaking through and you're busting the glass down. It's like, all right, well, you got to come through. And, you know, I'm thinking like, oh my God, if I trip and screw this up, like I'm going to keep going. I'm not breaking character. And we break through and we're walking. And I remember looking and I remember seeing Greg sitting down there with a camera, like watching this. And I'm thinking, okay, this is pretty awesome. We walk and we do our thing and George Yale's cut. So that was kind of like, all right, it was time for lunch. It was 4 or 5 hours. I didn't care. And I just remember George walking by and he stopped because I was with another guy and a couple other folks. We were just kind of saying, and he was, hey, thank you so much for coming here. I really appreciate it. And I was like, oh, George just said, thank you. So the guy I was with ended up getting like the nastiest migraine he could have imagined. So we ended up having to leave a little bit earlier, but we had lunch down in the lunch area, and Greg had brought props. So there was, and he had just done Identity. So I think it's Jake Busey has the bat shoved in his mouth, so that he had brought the dummy of Jake Busey with his like mouth open with the bat in it. And he had like a version of Rebecca De Mornay's head. And I think Kill Bill had come out at that point, because I want to say Lucy Liu's head was there. So it was really neat. And the catering was pretty fun. I was like, we were having a blast with that. And I remember going back and getting my makeup off and everything. And we drove back to the hotel and we couldn't stop smiling. We couldn't stop grinning. Like, oh my God, like we did it. We were George Romero zombies. And I'm like, we're never going to see this. Like we're never going to see us. And the first trailer comes out and I remember seeing my hand.
Oh man.
And I was like, oh my God, I'm in the movie. It's like, there's my hand. So that was just a, yeah, it's sometimes hard to believe that I did that. And it was such a minor role and such a minor part in such a big production, but I'm like, I got to do it. And I remember calling Greg after. I was like, dude, thank you so much. Like, I love you, man. He's like, oh man, it's all good. It's all good. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, that was Land of the Dead.
So you have that experience and then you're thinking, well, I can retire as a zombie. I can die happy. But then 4 years later, how did you end up in Survival of the Dead, which of course turned out to be George's last movie?
Yeah. My friends, Rob and Glenna live in Canada, and George at that time had emigrated to Toronto, and they got to see George and Suze a lot because George was doing stuff up there and they were also in Land of the Dead. So I would see them from time to time because they were coming to the U.S. a lot for conventions. And so I would see them once, twice, three times a year. And I remember emailing Rob and Glenna back and forth, and they were like, oh, we're going to, you know, George is filming in Hamilton. You know, we might go and see him. I was like, hey, ask him if we can come up. Offhanded comment. A couple hours later, Rob's like, hey, give me a call. I'm like, what's up? He said, hey, talk to Suze. They said we can come. She said, yeah, come on up. You know, you guys can come and hang out. You know, we don't know what we're doing that night, but, you know, let us know. These are the nights you can come. I was like, okay, that's pretty cool. So I was like, thank God I can get off work. And this is three nights. Land of the Dead was one night. Like, I got to Toronto on like a Tuesday morning, filmed, and we came home Wednesday. It was a very long, like 2 days. I think we're about 3-4 weeks out. Me and Rob and Glenn are emailing. We're like all excited. We don't know what we're going to do, but we're going to go see George make another movie. I remember Rob emailing me and he said, hey, I have a question. I was talking to George and he wanted to know, how attached to you are you to your hair? Like, what are you talking about? He goes, well, they're looking at maybe lighting someone on fire. And I kind of volunteered your name. And I was like, what?
Oh, thanks, buddy.
He goes, no. He goes, I'm just messing. He goes, but there's a good chance that we're going to be in makeup because they're, again, doing a big night. And I was like, oh, my God. So I remember getting to Toronto and checking into the hotel, and I was supposed to meet him, base camp. It was like 20 minutes from the hotel outside of Hamilton. And we meet up there, and Suze walks out of the trailer. It was the first time I really ever got to meet Suze outside of like a hello. And she's like, hi, guys, how are you? Oh, Matt, nice to meet you. And she's like, well, come on, we'll go over here. And there's this huge vinyl tent, like a big circus tent. And they check us in. They said, hey, we need extras for tonight. Let's go. And they're like, it's a fast and loose type of continuity. We're going to get you made up. We'll put you in. We'll see what we need. So I'm like, oh, my God. Like, no appliances, but they put makeup on me. And get me dressed up, and they send us over to the farm. So we're in the final shootout scene takes place in this farm, the Muldoons, and they put us in this barn. And they're like, all right, we're going to walk you out and you're going to be up on the fence and try to get out. And we end up being right up front, like right on the gate. Like, I'm pushed against the gate and there's like 30 zombies behind me. We're like, ah. And I'm like, this is the best thing ever. Like, I'm doing it again. And it was such a cold night and it was raining. So we did a bunch of takes. And again, obviously, I don't know any context about it. They're firing guns off, this, which was really cool. So they have us come out and they're like, all right, well, we're going to do this. And you walk this way and then you walk this way. So we were doing a whole mishmash of different scenes within the same set. And they were like, all right. Well, you know, it's 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. Sun's coming up. They're like, we'll see you guys tomorrow. And I go back to the hotel. I'm in full makeup. The only thing I did was change my clothes. I was in full makeup. I had blood on my face. I look, you know, disgusting. And I just remember going back to the hotel and be like, I'm sleeping in this makeup. I ain't taking it off. So we come back for the next night. And that night, I ended up getting in the makeup chair with the guy that ended up doing my makeup, taking my makeup off in Land of the Dead, a guy named Patrick. He remembered me. I was like, oh my God, you remember me. And that was the night that two of my other friends were there. My friend Mike, I'm friends with Mike Felsher from Redshirt Pictures. So he was following George and documenting. So they had him in makeup, and my friend Steve Barton, Uncle Creepy, was also there. So there was a bunch of us that knew each other, all these extras, and we were all hanging out. And I had this awesome airbrush makeup on the side of my head. It looked like veins had been drawn on. I was like, oh, this is awesome. And we did more of the same the next night. And the weather was a lot nicer. And we were being pushed around and everything else. And we did that and having a good time in the extras tent. We were just having a blast. And same thing. Go back to the hotel, sleep in the makeup. The guy didn't want to let me in the hotel because he saw my face. And I was like, it's okay. I'm making a movie. Third night was like the coldest night. Like, Canada, I experienced like summer, spring, and winter in like three nights. And the last night was like super cold. It was stupid cold. And we get makeup again, slightly different makeup, but same outfit. So we're up against it, and they're like, okay, well, tonight we have to let you out, and we're going to do this, and you, come here. And I was one of the yous. He said, hey, go over here. You're going to get shot. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to die in a George Romero movie? Next to eating somebody as a zombie in a George Romero movie, you want to get shot.
Right.
So I go over, and again, Patrick is there, and he puts this appliance in the middle of my forehead. He's like, oh, they're going to take this out in post. I'm like, oh, my God, someone's going to be CGIing me. Like, I'm like, okay, I'm like inside, like losing my shit. And they're like, all right, you're going to walk out here and you're going to get to this mat. You're going to take the shot and go down. So I'm out. I'm doing my shuffle. And I get to the, like, it was like a gym mat from elementary school. And he said, get there, and just, boom, head goes back and I go down. I had taken one extra step and my head missed the mat, and I like slammed my head on the ground. It wasn't that hard, but it was enough to like, oh, now I'm awake. You know, it's 2 a.m. Now I'm awake. And I think I did that about 4 times. I hit the mat every other time, but my neck started to hurt because I was selling it. I was like, pew, and you know, I was taking a shot. And I remember afterwards watching George and walking over, and he goes, oh, great job. You did great. And I was like, oh, George watched me do something. So I mean, the validation from George, just his thanks was all I really needed. And I remember going back to the hotel. I think I showered and I drove home. I think I slept for like 2 hours, and Toronto's about 7.5 hours away from home. So I was driving, and I was so hyped on adrenaline. I didn't need coffee or anything. I just remember driving. And I remember like crossing back into the States, and my cell phone at the time finally pinged back to the US. And I was like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. Cause we didn't, you know, the iPhones weren't a thing yet. And, you know, you didn't have laptops that could really use it across county, you know, country lines and whatnot. And I think I called my mom, called my wife. I called a friend. I was calling everyone. I was like, oh my God, this was awesome. And I remember going back in 2009 to the Toronto International Film Festival because they were doing the premiere. And I remember sitting with Rob and Glenna, and I'm sitting next to Glenna, and we see our scene coming up, and she grabs my hand, and we're holding on to it because we were just so excited. And we're like, oh my God, there we are. And, you know, Rob gets to eat some, you know, Rob starts to chew on someone. And I remember seeing my feet when they tear somebody off. They're like, go follow him. So I'm like, I'm following him along. And I just to see that on screen, like I saw myself die on screen.
Yeah.
And you can really pick me out in Survival versus Land. And at that time they were still doing the marketing. So it was really neat to see that night they used all of the zombies in a lot of the marketing material. So like I'm on like posters in Japan and Germany and all this stuff. I'm like, this is the greatest thing ever. And that is, I love Survival for that. And he had a lot of fun making that movie. A lot of people don't like it, and film's subjective, and I'm okay with that. But George loved making that. Now, he was on a tight crunch. I think they only had like a 26-day shooting schedule. And that was at the time we were joking. We're like, George, you know, zombies exist in the Caribbean, or they exist in the summertime. Can we not make a zombie film in the middle of winter? Would have been real nice to do like Tropic of the Dead or Beach of the Dead. But it's just one of those experiences. I don't know if I can ever properly articulate how awesome it was to watch George work.
Well, Matt, in case it's not very obvious, I'm insanely jealous over here. And I'm very happy that you got to experience, you know, being in not one, but 2 Romero movies. Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm extremely, you know, blessed to have great friends that would think of someone like me. I'm just some schlub, you know, I'm just some guy who loves George, who loves films, who loves to celebrate the things that brought me joy. And, you know, George opened up a whole world. George was my gateway drug to horror. And I have the best friends because of George. I still, you know, involved with obviously the Garf, but the movie convention scene and everything. So you meet the best people are horror movie fans.
Mm-hmm.
The
totally
best,
agree.
Most well-rounded people in the world, I believe, are horror movie fans. And we don't always agree. There's a lot of people that hate the stuff that I love, and I love the stuff they hate. And that's okay, because we have a good time with it. And but we're all there because we remember that one film we saw as a kid that sparked it. And mine was George.
Right. Before I let you go, I have to ask you about this book called 8 Days in the Woods. This is something that you wrote?
Yeah, 8 Days in the Woods, Blair Witch Project. My second favorite film. And why would you write a book about your second favorite film and not your favorite film? Well, George has been covered a lot. There's not much you can write about George that hasn't already been said. But I was lucky enough to be born in central Pennsylvania. I'm 2 hours from Philly, DC, Baltimore, 3 hours from Pittsburgh. And I thought for at least a good decade I was the only Blair Witch Project fan in the world. No one talked about it after it came out. After that sequel that we won't talk about came out in 2000, no one really talked about the film. And I would every year, middle of July, I'd get really excited. I was like, this is my annual Blair Witch viewing. And I remember meeting Eduardo Sanchez in 2004. A buddy of mine went to high school with him. So I got to meet Ed in 2004 and I was like, oh, this is really cool. And then 2012, I was making a movie called Fast Zombies Suck. And a buddy of mine said, hey, you need to talk to this guy named Adam. He does movie stuff and he just did Blair Witch. And it's Adam LeWoo for people that don't know.
Oh, sure.
So I got introduced to Adam LeWoo when I was making a movie and he's like, oh yeah, I just did the Blair Witch Project. Now I had only been to the house from the end of the film. I'd never gone to Burkittsville. I never did anything else, but I visited the house while it was still standing about 8 months after the movie had come out. And I was like, yeah, I need to go do this. And it wasn't until over a year later that I finally trekked down to Burkittsville and I had all my stuff written out. I'm going to go to Burkittsville. I'm going to go here. I'm going to do this. So my friend Michelle and I went down and we did a whole day and we went to where the house was and I couldn't exactly remember where the house was in the woods and I had known it had fallen down. So I was either looking for rubble, but I couldn't exactly pinpoint it. So we went home about a month or so later, me and two other friends went out and discovered where the house was. I remember walking around. Now this is the middle of July, so it's a lot of underbrush. It's grown over. But I was like, the ground moved and I looked and there's a big piece of sheet metal. And I looked, I'm like, oh, there's some big rocks here. I'm like, and we're looking around. I'm like, that looks like the siding of a house. So I had brought my picture of the house that I brought. And I'm like, that tree is in that. And I'm like, we found it. And we were like super excited. So we're like digging in the dirt, finding little bits of the house and whatnot. And I was talking to another guy and he's like, dude, you know how cool it would be if we went and like camped out and like did all the tours and everything. Let's invite Ed. So I remember being friends with Ed on Facebook and just messaging. And I didn't really know Ed. And I don't remember if he friended me or I friended him, but I was like, I'm friends with Ed Sanchez on Facebook. This is the coolest thing. And I was like, Ed, we're going to do a Blair Witch tour and whatnot. Did you want to come out? This is the date and whatnot. And he goes, you know, Ed's one of the super cool dudes. He's like, yeah, let's do it. So he goes on a podcast and he like puts it out there. And I get a message from someone. I'm like, I don't know who this person is. But she's like, hey, me and my son and his girlfriend want to come out to your thing. And I'm like, okay, let's meet in Burkittsville at 9 o'clock. I don't know her. She doesn't know me. So me and three people do the first Blair Witch Experience and meet up with Ed like midday. And Ed's like, well, do you want me to take you to where the stone piles were outside their tent? And I was like, yeah. So he takes us like down a trail, which is on the opposite side of Coffin Rock. And literally we walk up a mountain without a path. And he's like, well, and here we are and we're doing this. He goes, well, do you want to go where we hung the stick men? I was like, yeah, like the one location that I want to go to. So he drives us like it's like 3 miles away. And we're like standing in the woods where they hung the stick men. So I come home and I'm like, you know what, Blair Witch, it needs a Facebook group. So I made a Blair Witch group and I was like, you know, a couple people are going to join. It's just my little, you know, Blair Witch fanboyism. Well, it started to grow as Ed started to invite folks from the film, people that I didn't really know about. So people started asking, were you going to do this again? So the next year I had 6 people and then it was 12 people and then it was 20 people. And the third year, second or third year, I had asked Ed, the film was turning 15. So I was like, hey, is Lionsgate gonna do a new Blu-ray? You gonna do a documentary? He's like, nah. He goes, they're not into it. And I remember the words leaving my mouth before I could stop. And I was like, well, what if I wrote a book about how you made it? And he goes, all right, let's do it. I was like, shit. I'm not an author. I've never written anything. I've never really created anything. I said, okay, I guess I'll call you and we'll figure it out. He goes, yeah, absolutely. So I go home and I say to my wife, I was like, I think I'm writing a book. And she goes, what? What are you talking about? I say, yeah, I kind of told Ed I'd write the book about how they made the movie. And in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, it's going to be a booklet. Because I'm thinking, okay, they stumbled upon this. They made this movie and everything else, you know, we'll figure out. And Ed started introducing me to people. He's like, hey, you need to talk to Dan Myrick and Greg Hale and Ben Rock and Rob Cowie and all, Mike Minello. And I was like, okay. And it was one of those experiences where I was like, how do I tell this story? So I had to start figuring out, okay, what do I know? What don't I, you know, what do I want to know more about? And okay, this is going to be the list of stuff that I don't know. I don't know what I don't know. I started building a roadmap and I was trying to figure out, okay, well, I'm going to do this in chronological order. I want to find out, okay, how'd you guys meet, this and this. So I started interviewing the guys like, okay, let's start at the beginning. And they would mention a name. I'm like, who's that? Oh, okay. And then I'd be like, wait, what you did this when and what was this called? So I started building this roadmap of people and places and times. And their archivist, a gentleman named Dan Karcher, was like, well, I have a tote of all the Hi-8 tapes that they used for the behind the scenes footage. Like they documented a lot of the movie process before, during, and after. And he only lived about 2 hours from me. So it took him about a year and a half for me to get a hold of it because he was his work schedule and stuff. I'd be like, Dan, I can come over. And I wouldn't hear from him for 3 weeks. And I love Dan, but you know, he might not call me back for 3 weeks, but then we'll talk for 5 hours. So I go out and I get this tote of Hi-8 tapes and there had to be, I don't know, 60 of them.
Wow.
And they were almost all of them were full. So I spent like 3 months digitizing them.
Wow.
And you have to digitize in real time.
Yeah.
So I would watch it and I would take notes. And now they weren't really labeled the best. So I might be watching auditions. I might be watching telephone calls during editing. I might be watching behind the scenes of actual filming. But I would watch and I would take notes and I'm like, okay, well, this happens here and this happens here. And then Dan had said, oh, by the way, you know, Ed and Dan and Ed's wife, Steph, kept a diary of production. And I'm like, no. So he gave me these like diaries where they would come home at the end of the night and be like, oh, today we did this and it was a great shot. And Josh, and they were date stamping it. I was like, oh my God.
I feel like this book might turn into a little bit more than a booklet.
Yeah. And so I had all these dates and times. Now I had started to interview people from time to time that I knew. I was like, okay, I need a one-off interview with such and such a person. And during that process, I was doing a lot of Googling and a lot of Facebook searching because I was trying to find people that were involved. Because I'm like, if I interview a lot of people, then I have enough content to pull from and I can get a complete picture because I didn't want to not interview someone and then miss something critical.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember I wanted to talk to the mom who was holding the baby. Come to find out, if you used to go on IMDb, she was credited as Jackie Hallix. Okay, so I'm going to look for Jackie Hallix. I spent 3 weeks. Now, over the course of the year, I'd go back to it every once in a while, but I remember spending about 3 weeks. Like, I need to find who this person is. I'm trying to find phone numbers. I'm trying to find relatives. And I get a call from Ed one day. He said, hey, are you still looking for the mom from the film? And I was like, yeah. He goes, I just ran into somebody that knows her. And I was like, you got a name, right? Like, I'm thinking like, of course he would. He wouldn't be calling me. And he tells me her name. He's like, her name's Susie Gooch. I'm like, holy shit. So I go on Facebook and I find her. And she looked exactly the same because her profile picture had her wearing glasses. And I'm like, that's the woman. So I messaged her and pinged edit. And I was like, hey, my name's Matt. I'm writing a book about how they made the Blair Witch Project. I have been searching for you and your daughter. I would really love to talk to you. And I did CC Ed on this, so you know that it's legit, because I didn't know anything. And she's like, oh my God, that's so awesome. Yeah, me and Ingrid would love to see you. Why don't let's do lunch next week? Like, they were my white whale. Like, I probably wouldn't be proud of the book had I not found them. A week later, I was having lunch with the mom and the baby, who had become two of my absolute best friends in the world, Susie and Ingrid. Wow. And I didn't know at the time that they weren't planted actors. She came up with her story on the cuff. And they had known about it, but they weren't part of the community. And they had such a great time at lunch. And they, you know, I was like, hey, I saw a little bit of footage from your dad. They were taking their dad or Susie's dad out for his birthday at the diner where they interviewed him. And so we were talking about that, and come to find out they had never met anybody from the film. The only interaction they had with any cast or crew from the Blair Witch Project was the day Heather, Mike, and Josh interviewed them.
Oh, wow.
So knowing that I pulled them in, I was like, oh my God, do you guys understand? Like, you guys are like fan favorites. Like, your scene is like one of the best. Come to find out that Susie and the fisherman, Ed Swanson, the tall, skinny fisherman, this is all that's bullshit, actually hang around in the same motorcycle club. So just those weird connections. So it was great building this community of people that had been involved in the film that maybe really didn't know each other or hadn't connected in 10, 15 plus years. It was a lot. Like, once I really got a rhythm down, I was like, this is interesting. And, you know, editing the film was a whole part of the book that I didn't realize how much fun I was having writing, because the editing part of the film, I think, is more interesting than the filming of the movie itself, because the film ended up becoming what it was, but it was supposed to look like the Sci-Fi Channel special.
Mm.
So they had all this footage and they couldn't mesh it together.
And accidentally ended up kind of creating a whole subgenre because of it.
Yeah, it was not intended to be, you know, they found footage wasn't a phrase we, you know, used back in the 90s, but it needed an outside person. Kevin Fox got invited to a screening that they showed a 3.5 hour cut of the film. And he goes, you guys got your movie. And they're like, no, we're not done yet. And he goes, no, you have your movie. Take everything else, lock it in the cabinet, edit this down. You've got your movie. So they spent a lot of time. Ed and Dan actually did like dueling edits. They each edited the film in their own way. And they had to come to a consensus that we need to take out anything that is not in the woods and just make this. And that story to me was one of the most fascinating. And I spend a lot of time in the book talking about that, because Mike Bonello, the phrase of the movie was found in the edit. And that always stuck with me, is they knew they had a movie, but they didn't know what movie they had until they edited it, looked at it, and they said, wow, this works.
Mm-hmm. Well, they, you know, the old catchphrase is you make three movies, the one that you write, the one that you shoot, and the one that you edit. And sometimes in that editing process, you find, you know, it turns into something that you weren't expecting.
Yeah. And that was that in a nutshell. I mean, the film started out, it was a very grandiose idea. They were actually talking about, well, they're driving down the road and all of a sudden they start seeing old cars like from the 70s. And then they pull into town and everyone's dressed like, why is this the 70s? It's supposed to be the 90s. So they had all these grandiose ideas about building a house in the woods with a cellar and digging the cellar out and having all this stuff. Then they realized, hey, we can't do that. We've got credit cards. We don't have a budget.
Right.
So they trimmed it down and made the movie with the means that they had. The movie isn't trying to be something it's not. And they worked with that, and they had the good approach of, okay, we know what we need to do. We know what our limits are, and let's just do it. I mean, they didn't come up with the ending of Mike in the Corner until 2 days before they shot it.
Oh, wow.
So learning all of that and wanting to tell this complete story, I didn't want the book to read like vacuum cleaner instructions. I didn't want it to be, and then on this day, they walked into the woods and found a spot to film. Like, I wanted to tell the story. I wanted their voices to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me about 4 years because I'm not a writer. I work a full-time job. I have a life, family. And George passing away in the middle of that really threw me off. I think it took me about 2 months to get back into the book once George passed. But once I got to the end where I knew I was covering everything and I was getting to the nitty gritty and was like, okay, let's talk about the legacy of it. I sat down and wrote, that was 2018, August of 18. By March of 2019, the book was done. And I think four or five solid months of writing, because I would have to transcribe all the interviews and have to work with their schedules. Like, hey, I need 20 minutes to go over something. And I would be rounding back with folks over and over because I had to make sure it was all right. You know, this isn't fiction. So I was really hesitant on forgetting anything, misquoting someone, or just being flat out wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I was constantly re-engaging everybody to say, hey, just to confirm, this was the order that it happened, or this is who said it. And I remember looking at it and I remember typing the end and I was like, I need to go for a drink and going through and editing and seeing the book when it was done, I was like, I hope people want to read this. Because there's, you know, self-doubt in a writer's sure. mind that, you know, no one's going to read it. Everyone's going to hate it. But the first time I held a copy in my hand, I was like, this is so weird. And a side effect of the book that I didn't intend on, but I think was pretty cool, is a couple of people have come back to me and they're like, I'm a filmmaker. And this really helped put a lot of stuff into context, or really gives me the excitement to go make a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So it's become kind of this, hey, if these guys can do it, and you know, because like I said, I went into detail because I wanted to. It's a little self-serving, you know, whether that's good, bad, or indifferent. I wanted to tell this story. So there was some history. But a lot of folks have latched on to, oh, well, that's how they did that? Well, maybe I can do that. So I'm hoping, I would love to see a filmmaker finally get their film made, whether it's distributed or not. I want a filmmaker to make their film. And if they were inspired by that's one of the most humbling things I could ever think of.
Yeah.
But just that, you know, I wanted people to enjoy this oral history of the Blair Witch Project because it was so much more than me, even as a huge fan of it, ever imagined. And to me, I think it's, I don't know if we'll ever get a documentary. There's enough footage out there that they could, but I'm kind of hoping that'll stand the test of time, that people look back at a film that we're still talking about 23 years later, that will look at it and go, oh, I get it now. I get why this was a phenomenon. And that's all I can hope for with it at this point.
Well, congratulations on finishing the book. And, where can people go online? We'll post links down below on bmoviemania.com, but where can people go if they would like to check it out?
You can get the book on Amazon. I also have a website for the Blair Witch Experience, blairwitchexperience.com. I have to get some links up there if people want to buy the book from there. And then we all hang out on Facebook. Just type in the Blair Witch Project group on Facebook. You'll see us. We're on there, and the Experience has a Facebook page. I'm actually low on stock right now. I have to order some more copies. I sold a bunch at the Mahoning Drive-In in Lehigh, PA. Just showed the Blair Witch on 35 millimeter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Blair Witch on 35 is something I have traveled the country for.
That's awesome.
It's, you know, the 35 millimeter prints of that film, there's not a lot.
Right.
And so to see it on 35 millimeter is, I think that's the fourth or fifth time since post 1999 that I've seen it on 35 millimeter, but I never saw it at a drive-in.
Mm-hmm.
So they invited me up to do a little cast crew reunion, and I was selling some books. So I'm a little low on stock, but yeah, Facebook, blairwitchexperience.com, or Amazon is where you can find it. There's Blair Witch Experience Instagram page. You can find me and, you know, we can hang out and chat.
Yeah. And like I said, we'll have links down below to all of that on bmoviemania.com. Matt, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Listen up, maniacs. Do you have a question or a comment? Would you like to send some bourbon to Uncle Lloydy? You can contact the gang on Facebook at B-Movie Mania. You can also drop them a line at bmoviemania.com. Reach out, touch them. They're touching themselves, and they might just reach back. I'm Lloyd Kaufman saying, see you next time on B-Movie Mania. Woohoo!